Hi, everyone, and welcome to our first ever in a series of Country First Conversations. We're excited to launch this brand new series and allow you to participate and be a part of the conversation in choosing country over party. Congressman Adam Kinzinger launched the movement Country First as a home for principled Americans who are simply tired of the poisonous extremism that has overtaken our beloved nation's politics. And if you haven't joined the movement just yet, oh, there's plenty of time. Come on in. Invite you on right now. Go visit the website, countryfirst.com. That's with a one in the URL, countryfirst.com. You're going to hear that website name over and over again as we continue on. Make sure you get a chance to go watch Representative Kinzinger's video where he talks about the state of the Republican Party and the need to reject the politics of personality, lies, and conspiracy, and to go back to the Republican principles that have proven to drive peace and prosperity in America for generations to come. My name is Matt Rodewald. I will be hosting today's chat. Good to be with all of you today. And joining me this evening are Representative Adam Kinzinger from Illinois. He is a six-term congressman whose district, as of now, goes from Cherry Valley to Cisna Park, from Wisconsin to Watseka, and from McChesney Park to Milford. Did I get all those right? I think.
Yeah, you got it.
It's an interesting map when you look at it. Also tonight, please say hello to first-term Representative Peter Meyer from Michigan. So let's start right into it tonight as we talk about the need to reject politics of personality from both parties and the idea of self-promotion in politics and the desire to do politics based on gaining fame and name recognition only. Adam, let's start with you because you've been there longer and you've seen it change over the past couple of years as the digital age really has matured a little bit. How do you see the changes impacting this issue?
They've been pretty bad. I mean, I think, you know, the bottom line when you look at what's going on, initially when people came here, it was the idea, I was elected in the class of 2010. The class of 2010 was all about we need to cut spending, principles, policy moving forward. And I think with the invention, I guess, of new media, social media, and then the starting of this thing called going viral, right? You know, now everything's going viral. People understood that they can get attention. Maybe it started at a good spot, like we can get attention by doing something crazy or saying something or having something groundbreaking. But then in the bottom line, when it was all said and done, it's kind of turned into that being the driving force. And so our conversations have gotten angry. Our actions have gotten angry. We've started to focus on peddling fear. And, look, I feel bad for my friend Peter, who comes here to do his very first term and gets to jump right into a January 6th insurrection. And but that's what we're committed to, is bringing that conversation back just to be adults again. How about that?
I like adultism. That's a good adulting, as we all talk about. You know, Peter, it's interesting you brought that up. It's kind of the first thing you did. For you, it's kind of the reverse. You've seen a lot of these people on TV spouting some of this stuff off, and now you're having the one-on-one conversations for the first time. There has to be some sort of level of intrigue with how it's kind of unfolded for you.
Yeah, I mean, just to touch on Adam's point earlier, it's like maturity. What a concept, right? Being an adult, taking responsibility for your actions, you know, things that most people learn somewhere between kindergarten and elementary school. There has been that question in my mind, right? And I've my background's as kind of an interrogator and a source handler in the Army. And so it always intrigued me kind of what's motivating somebody, right? How do they define success within kind of the rationality and worldview? And I think the way in which I've been most fundamentally naive entering politics is I kind of assumed that somebody who's a member of a political party, you know, that has ostensibly political beliefs and an ideology, or at least principles that they have an affinity towards, that they could view success or winning as achieving legislative victories, you know, moving the country in the direction they feel it needs to go. And it wasn't until I started having conversations and meeting some folks and I realized, oh, no. Success can be just having a really good fundraising quarter, making sure in your district that you get reelected. Because you can always find someone to blame for why you couldn't pass this piece of legislation. Or maybe you don't even care enough to find somebody to blame. You just want to spend more time on cable news. And that not going to lie, a little dispiriting, a little disappointing. I mean, because again, I mean, what are the taxpayers paying us for if not to try to be stewards, fiduciaries of this American experiment?
Yeah, and I think I'll also say on that, like part of the huge thing that started to concern me is just the long arc of what does this mean for the future? You know, I'm about to be 43, my goodness. And yeah, I know, dude, I'm old. But to see, like, you know, when I was a kid, I do remember Ronald Reagan. You remember just politics, and you've seen the steady decline, not just as I've been in. And it's like, okay, let's say a 25-year-old now really hasn't seen any mature politics for the most part. There's been mature moments, but, you know, how do we expect them to come in and rescue this if they've never seen an example to the counter? It's not going to be reading history books. It's going to be like, well, look, I'm passionate about Congress, so the arc to get there is to promote myself, which, you know, self-promotion in politics happens, but it's promote myself above all else. And my principles will vary based on whatever's going to bring me the most attention.
It was always kind of an underlying thing, yeah, that self-promotion element, but there is still work to be done. And, you know, for you, Adam, I've always wondered, what's it like when you're dealing with these people who are maybe being truthful to you, but then when you get them, you know, you see them behind a podium or with a microphone clipped on them, it's very different. It's got to be either frustrating or it's almost baffling in some sense, is it not?
Yeah, it is. It's just like, you know, you get... It's weird because, and Peter's probably even started to see this in just the short, but, you know, very active time he's been here, is, you know, everybody kind of gets along one-on-one pretty well. You know, it could be somebody that you just had a big Twitter spat with or something, and you're going to ride on the train over to vote together, and you're like, hey, what's up? And, you know, that's one thing. But the problem is people don't get to see that behind the scenes. What they see is when the lights come on, are you the person that's yelling and screaming and promoting yourself? And so in their mind, the average American's mind, because it's all they see, all we do is just punch each other proverbially and sometimes physically right in the mouth. When in reality, you know, we get along for the most part, just like you should at a family on Thanksgiving that disagrees, right? Nothing wrong with getting along.
Well, as long as certified letters aren't being mailed to your house, then I guess everything's going to be just fine. Well,
I got to tell you, though, that was like the most surprising thing. For those that don't know, my dad's cousin sent a certified letter, and it opened up with "What a disappointment," all caps, underlined, and it was handwritten, by the way. "What a disappointment you have become. You've embarrassed the family name, and you're in the devil's army." And it's interesting because it's like, I'm as conservative as anybody. I just don't want to beat people down to win, because you can't win that way. You know, like Peter and I disagree on some things. I think on foreign policy, we see things probably quite a bit differently in some areas, but, you know, he's wrong, and that's okay. No, I'm kidding. Well, I'll tell you, I have more respect for Peter than I do probably 99% of people in Congress, because I know he believes what he's saying. That, to me, is the biggest thing. Do you believe it, or are you just showing?
Well, and the thing that I was surprised by on the floor kind of the first time was, you know, or on some of these issues where there's no whipping of the vote, right? You know, so you're not necessarily having a policy recommendation coming from, you know, the your side of the aisle, and there'd be, you know, a bunch of folks kind of looking around, they weren't thinking, okay, let me dive deep into this issue. Let me better understand all the nuances and the ramifications. You know, what's the consequence of this vote going to be? It was purely, how do I make sure I don't wind up in the minority? Right. I want safety in numbers. I don't want to be left on an island by myself. And I'm not saying that's everybody, but I was frankly a little shocked at the amount of times where it was clear that it was, you know, trying to figure out what direction the wind was blowing. And I think, you know, part of this is just, you know, and this is something I definitely don't want us to dwell on, but I actually saw an opportunity in coming into office right now, to bring back a sense of, okay, let's orient around some principles. Let's take those principles and build out policies along them. I mean, obviously, the Republican Party has coalesced around a number of issues, but then there's plenty of areas where we can have a good, robust intellectual debate and have differing opinions, right? Being just not having an area of disagreement shouldn't be a deal breaker, right? I mean, if you find anybody you agree with 100%, you know, they're either lying to you 100% of the time, or you haven't learned enough about them, right? I mean, there should be room for those healthy disagreements, but instead, and I fear this is what happens to a party where, you know, under kind of President Trump, there were obviously some deeply held kind of convictions, and there were some places where, and I'm thinking of the omnibus bill at the end of the year, where, I mean, it was negotiated by his team, it was his budget. I know there were members who, you know, thought it was spending too much, but wanted to, wanted to support, you know, kind of President Trump. And all right, so they take the vote, it passes. Then the reaction isn't great, and the president kind of gets up and rails against it. And it was just that sense of there's no point in sticking your neck out on anything or raising your head up, you know, because, you know, it'll get cut off, or you put your head above the parapet and can catch a bullet pretty easily. And what does that do? It means all you're doing is reacting to what the crowd in front of you is enjoying. Well, and it becomes a reactive sense of leadership. It's not, here's where I think we need to go. It's like, hey guys, where do you want to go? Are you sure? Are you sure? Okay, let's go there. Oh, you're changing your mind. You know, and I mean, it's not leadership.
It's interesting, because I think actually one of Peter's biggest blessings, even if he doesn't realize it yet, was taking a tough stand and a tough vote, besides her hair, you know, the beautiful locks of hair. Almost be an Air Force pilot with that, yeah. But you know, one of the biggest blessings is taking a crappy hard vote, you know, that ticks people off early on. Because when I took my first tough early on vote, it ends up being the stuff you're most proud of, because you know what you're made of and you know that you meant it. And it also teaches you that you can survive if you believe in what you're doing. And, you know, the biggest, this will derail us totally, but I'll just finish with this. That one of the bigger problems, you know, C-SPAN is great because it gives access and transparency into what's going on in government. But it also took the debate from a real debate on the floor discussing issues to what's the 1 minute or 2 minute or 3 minute speech I can say that'll get me on C-SPAN and maybe noticed by, you know, literally 12s of people at a time, you know, but if I'm lucky, the media will pick up on it. And so everything becomes a soundbite, even in debate. Mm-hmm.
You are listening to a Country First Conversation on Clubhouse with Adam Kinzinger of Illinois and Peter Meyer of Michigan. Make sure you go to our website, Country First, that's with a one, countryfirst.com. Make sure you're following us on Facebook and Twitter as well. All right, Peter, I want to ask you about that January 6th vote. Let's start with truth and that vote, because avoiding the truth is what kind of set up that day, and it forced everyone to face it in an impeachment vote. It was one of your first votes. It had to be quite the initiation, but based on what you guys have been saying, was there an element of liberation with it? Just that you feel like, you know what, now I can just go.
Well, you know, obviously, are we talking about the Electoral College certification? Because yes. I also felt a tremendous sense of liberation after
Walk
that.
Walk me through all of it. We got time to unpack all of this. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that, you know, back in those naive days pre January 6th, we thought that the Electoral College certification would be political suicide. I mean, I think there were members of the president's family who had promised that they would be in our backyards primarying us if we didn't, you know, vote to overturn the election. And I was deeply concerned because, you know, some of the intellectual debates that were happening, you know, on the floor and among members were, you know, prudential questions of non-legislative electoral process modifications at the state level, and then questions about the constitutionality of the Electoral Count Act of 1887, and, you know, some pretty arcane things. How that was being interpreted on the outside was, well, yeah, it was a landslide victory for Donald Trump that was stolen, and here's your ability to overturn this election and or overturn the fraudulent election and give it back to Donald Trump. So I was very worried about that mismatch. I had given an interview the day before to a local reporter where I guess I went was a little liberated and said, I'm deeply worried about the possibility for violence on the 6th. I mean, I would talk to people who were coming out and, you know, I knew the fervor that was there was completely out of step with the conversations happening inside the Capitol. And by and large, I mean, there were definitely some stop the steal proponents, but, you know, I was in the House chamber, you know, we I remember telling a colleague, this is the safest place for us to be. And, you know, then people start pounding on the doors and we hear that there's been tear gas and they tell us to get down because they're worried people start firing in there, and hearing that there have been shots fired. And then Capitol Police kind of rush us out, put us down in the tunnels. We're wandering around, know that this building's been evacuated, know that there are pipe bombs that were found over here. And it's hard to understate just the degree of chaos that day. And frankly, looking back, it's incredible how, I mean, it was a tragic day, but how lucky we were. I mean, it is so easy to imagine scenarios where scores more people die, where more police officers are killed, where, it's just, everything was set up to make that into the confrontation and the violent conflagration that it was. And then obviously after that, you know, I think we tried to do everything we could to not go down the path that we were. I sponsored a censure resolution, you know, saying let's have a swift, you know, condemnation. But obviously we're not in control. Speaker Pelosi wanted to put Republicans in the toughest corner they could. And ultimately, when the article of impeachment was drafted and put before us, you know, my job was to review it, see whether or not it was accurate. And then if it was accurate, whether or not impeachment was the sufficient remedy. And on both of those questions, I answered yes. It was something where I went back and forth for, I think, the entire time we had it. I would go to sleep thinking I would vote one way, I'd wake up the other. I mean, every argument in the book I kind of made with myself, and ultimately couldn't convince myself that there was a way I could do anything but vote for impeachment.
I got to add to that with just because I got to brag on Peter for a second. I'm tired of doing this, but, you know, look, I did a podcast on the Bulwark with Charlie Sykes, and this was when this idea of decertifying was coming up, which, by the way, it's ludicrous to think that when this country was founded, they thought people would look on Twitter and see if an election was stolen and make a decision in D.C. whether or not to accept electoral votes. We just simply accept that they came, right? I mean, so you think about it, you know, the message there. But so he Charlie Sykes asked me, he goes, do you think there's going to be upwards of 20 people voting to decertify? And I just laughed and I go, Charlie, it's going to be over 100. And he's like, no way. It ended up being 138, because you see how that fear is contagious. You know, fear is something that has permeated what we do. Fear is healthy in many ways, right? I'm fearful of disunity. I'm fearful of the pandemic. I'm fearful of, you know, Chinese aggression, right? I am not fearful that Nancy Pelosi is going to kill my family, right? I'm going to fight. I'm going to do a political battle against her on issues I believe in. But it's not fearful, but people are so fearful of losing their election. So that leads me to what I wanted to say about Peter, which is the guy's a freshman. You know, he's, how old are you? You're 32 or something?
33. Come 33. On, don't demote.
Give him the year. Yeah.
Kids. Well, that's about how old I was when I was elected. I was a little younger, of course. You know, the idea of taking a career-ending vote your very first term, like, that's tough, right? You may be a one term. I think he's going to end up being here a while, quite honestly. Courage. Justin Amash was his predecessor, and I like Justin a lot. I disagree with him on just about everything, but he was courageous. And so courage must run in that district's blood. But he reached out to me. I don't know if I can tell this, but I'm going to tell it anyway. Peter reached out and said, hey, I've seen you out there. I didn't know who he was. And he's like, I wanted to chat. And I was like, wow, this freshman dude wants to lead. And that means a lot.
Thank you. Well, and you left out the fact that you ignored me for like 2 weeks.
I did, but I never look at Signal, man. You sent it on okay. Signal. Yeah. But then I also had to research who this, you know, flowy red hair guy is.
Yeah. Thank you, Adam. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Nothing wrong with flowy red hair. I'll ask my daughter that. She'll agree with you on that.
That's right. Got to play hard to get a little bit.
Exactly. You know, Adam, the vote itself that both of you guys took, it's been described as courageous. Fair word?
No. I guess given the context, yeah. But it shouldn't, you know, it's kind of sounds asinine to say now because everybody said it, but it shouldn't be courageous, right? Here's the bottom line for some quick theory. When I was in poli sci in college, you know, always the debate, do you represent the wishes of the district or do you represent what you believe? And the answer is both. You know, on the interests of the district, I have 4 nuclear power plants. I'm going to fight like hell to preserve those nuclear power plants in the 16th district. That is the district's interests that I have to advocate for. But out of the 750,000 people I represent, there is only one person in this capacity that swears on an oath to the Constitution of the United States. That is me. They don't make every citizen swear to defend the Constitution as a congressman, because there are times where you have to do tough things. And you know, everybody has a right to be against impeachment or for impeachment as an opinion. But when you sign up, when you swear that oath to the Constitution, that right, now you can have an interpretation of what defending that is, but you lose the right to have an opinion on whether you should defend it or not. And, you know, so is it courageous? Like I said, I guess in this day and age, yes. Should it be? No, because in my mind, I said there was an insurrection that I have no doubt, because I've been watching for 4 years, that the base was built for it. This can never be acceptable. If this isn't impeachable, nothing is. And people that came to a fair-minded position the other way, I don't blame at all. But if somebody decided to vote against impeachment, but they thought they should have, but they worried about their reelection, that's a different story.
Yeah. I mean, it's... I had someone in the district reach out, and they're like, "You coward, you buckled to the pressure. They got to you. You have no spine." And I just want to be like, "What pressure?" Like, there was no, all of the pressure was going in one way and towards, and that was towards conformity. Though I will give our, I will give the kind of House leadership on the Republican side, I'll give Leader McCarthy credit that this was not a whipped vote. Right. When we say it was a vote of conscience, I think people oftentimes think that that means that it was that we were just saying we voted with our conscience, when actually it literally means like you're not being told or recommended which way to go, which was a marked departure. So it wasn't something that necessarily puts you at odds with leadership in sort of a relational sense. But it was, to me, you know, I think getting back to that question of liberation, you know, I can go home at night and look in the mirror and just be like, yep, I'm not ashamed of myself. And there's a lot to be said for that, right? I mean, that sense of it was definitely not the easy thing. It was not the thing, you know, I don't think any reaction that the 10 of us have received is something that surprised us. You know, but I think if you're also going into a vote saying what's going to make things easiest for me, or what's going to put me on the smoothest path to reelection, that becomes a pretty messed up way of viewing it. And frankly, once you start doing that, where do you stop? You know, at what point have you abandoned any idea of fidelity to a set of underlying principles or to a moral framework, and you become just completely self-serving?
Yeah, and if you think about, so the country of Georgia, I'm a big fan of, I'm one of the heads of the Georgia caucus, been there a number of times, and, you know, it's a new democracy, relatively speaking, and they've struggled, but they're great, huge ally, right? So I've been involved in some of their election drama, I guess, and what I've realized, something that stood out both there and in other democracies, is you end up where these countries, it's not like a party that has a set of principles. You know, the Republican Party still does have a set of principles, even if we fail them, but people can tell you what they are. They're parties that are surrounding personalities. And so you have two strong personalities that each have a party, and they're doing battle. And there's no way besides the victory of a personality that'll win. And that fails. And that's what I fear has happened to us, is, you know, it becomes a loyalty to a person. It becomes, hey, if this person who I trust more than you says something, I'm not going to listen to anything you say. And that's what we have to come back and defend hard against. And I think, you know, I think in the long run, it's I think our vote's going to be seen, obviously, I have no doubt, in history as the right vote. I think even before 2 years from now. But I also think, you know, this is the time when strength is made. And I think people like Peter, frankly, will be, you know, huge leaders going forward and saying, yeah, let me tell you about this one time I did something. Now listen to what I have to tell you now.
You are listening to a Country First conversation with Adam Kinzinger of Illinois and Peter Meyer of Michigan, the only member of Congress that Adam can say, when I was your age. Yeah. Go to our website, countryfirst.com. Make sure you're following us on Facebook and Twitter as well. All right, the movie Roadhouse. You both have seen it, right? You tell me you've both seen the movie.
You've not
seen Roadhouse, Peter?
Dude, it came out before I was born.
That doesn't matter. I was nine when it came out.
I've seen the Family Guy interpretation.
Okay, too. Well, yeah.
That's a different version of it. Yes.
Roadhouse.
Look, there's a scene where Patrick Swayze is basically introduced to everybody, and essentially they got to clean up this bar. So he's got three simple rules. One, never underestimate your opponent. Two, take it outside. Never fight inside the bar. You got to take it outside. And the last one is relevant here. This is why I bring it up. Number three, be nice. Now, Adam, you tweeted a note of congratulations to Joe Biden for winning the election. You got a lot of flack for something that was normal. The truth is, Biden, of course, won the election. But I want to start with Peter on this one, because how frustrating is it for you when you're trying to be noble and honorable in such a way and it's met with resistance?
You know, I've actually, two things. I mean, I'll say after it became my line after, you know, the election was, you know, that everyone has a right to pursue their legal challenges. And a reporter kind of put a microphone in my face. I'm like, well, you think Donald Trump will accept the results of the election and have a peaceful transition of power? I'm like, of course, come on. What planet are you guys living on? So I'm a little bit embarrassed at some of that. But, you know, when the Electoral College was certified, I also not accepted by Congress, but in mid-December, you know, I put out a statement, you know, acknowledging President-elect Biden. Didn't catch as much flack as I thought it for. I mean, just the amount of times you're in this day and age walking on just sort of the most fragile eggshells you could imagine. You know, I'm just sitting there just kind of wincing, waiting for it, and nothing happened. But that sense of, I've actually found, and maybe this is just, I don't know. I just tend to think that being a decent, respectful person costs you nothing. And there are a lot of people I've been censured by two of my counties. I have wonderful relationships with the folks there. And it wasn't, you know, you traitorous son of a, I mean, it was like, listen, we are disappointed in this vote, fundamentally disagree. Okay, fair. I mean, that's, I like to bracket things into, you know, reasonable people can disagree on X, right? Or you can make an argument here. I really struggle to find a way that reasonable people can agree. I don't think reasonable people can disagree on whether or not Dominion voting machines, you know, hacked in and flipped votes and Hugo Chavez and server farms in Germany. I mean, I've watched the entire 2 hours of the Mike Lindell's absolute proof. I watched the entire thing. I mean, I listened to it. You didn't really need to look at it. But it, and I think the thing that's sad to me is when you have folks who are just kind of grasping for straws, right? They are trying to justify and find evidence for what they believe and disregard anything that might challenge it, no matter how overwhelming or convincing, you know, it gets to a point where, you know, I can be kind of polite and respectful, and I don't blame anybody for listening and putting their trust in leaders who ultimately mislead or deceive them. I mean, I blame that leader. But, you know, I don't know. I'll say I've had people call me, you know, angrily, but not disrespectfully, and say, oh, I'm going to support your primary opponent. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. And, you know, they just start kind of going at it. And, you know, after 5 minutes of them kind of getting everything off their chest, I just say, you know, do you have another 10 minutes? Because I'd love to, I don't expect you to agree, you know, but I want you to at least understand how I arrived at what I did. And, you know, in that particular conversation, after about 10 minutes, the guy offered up, well, and now that you say it, I think the Georgia phone call was probably impeachable too. All right, I didn't even offer that. So, I mean, I think it's important to kind of meet people where they are, to be respectful, to have a sense of grace and kind of kindness. And even in the face of somebody yelling, I mean, what good does it do to yell back, right? I mean, all you're doing is escalating a situation and making people retreat further and further, dig in their heels deeper and deeper. And then you're never going to be able to create a sense of respect that allows you to build trust, that allows you to have somebody say, you know what, now that you think about it. And that's, I think, what leaders should do.
Amen.
Now, it's hard to spend 20 minutes with, you know, 730,000 people is the challenge, right? And being able to do that is hard. It's a lot easier to just say, you traitorous rhino, you know, whatever, like Adam is.
We all know it. We all know it. There's a media element to this, Adam, because, you know, you put the tweet out, people make a big deal, CNN puts it up there, you know, and then all of a sudden it's played up quite a bit. Do they have a role in actually, you know, saying, you know what, this is just standard operating procedure for this sort of thing, or it should be in normal times, and just maybe not, you know, hype it up so much?
I think normally, but this isn't normal times. And, you know, I honestly, when I put that tweet out, it was mainly because I wanted to brag that I was married to Sophia, because I said, Sophia and I congratulate. And
it's the first time you've had a chance to do that, right?
Yeah. I'm like, check her out. She's awesome. But, you know, I just did that thinking that's a gentleman's thing to do. And when I saw the reaction, I'm like, oh, this is not going to be pretty. And I didn't mean it like, oh, it's going to hurt me. It's like there's some real rot, and it's not the people that are reacting. It's that they've been misled. And I think media, you know, we have that's a whole another podcast on First Amendment stuff we could do, but, you know, they have a responsibility. That's why I'm a huge fan, by the way, of local media, because it's pretty fact-based. And I think, you know, anybody that tells me, hey, I don't know where to get my news from, it's like, well, if you have local media, use that. And I think so. Yeah, it's that. And it's just like, I think some of these news networks have a responsibility to say when they're venturing into opinion versus fact. And I, maybe it can't be something the government should force, but it should be something that a good news station should do. Cause I think some people see opinion, and if it's put with an official title after an official opening, sometimes it feels like fact.
Before I get back to Peter, I want to note out that everyone in the room still listening here on Clubhouse, if you have a question, make sure you raise your hands and we'll try and bring you on here and jump into the conversation. I know we've been at it for a good half an hour and we're running out of time a little bit, but we do want to get some questions out there. So go ahead and make sure that you raise your hands. Peter, you know, kind of along those lines, this quote stuck out to me from November. What I've always tried to do is step back from the feelings and go back to facts. That seems simple. It seems simple for you.
I mean, it's, you know, I try to look at everything on its merits. And I think you know, talk about what Adam was saying, I think he's absolutely right about local news. And my frustration with much of the media has been, you know, the idea of, like, if I read the New York Times, right, I'm a lot more confident that the facts in the New York Times are going to be largely very accurate. Where I might get frustrated is how some of those facts are assembled into a narrative. I remember being when I was working in Iraq, and it was just like, okay, no, you, well, actually there were some times where I had to reason, like, nope, that actually happened here. Like, I was there. But by and large, I mean, the challenge is distinguishing between a set of facts that, you know, are packaged in a narrative that, you know, has a sense of subjectivity, you know, versus there are some other stations that I won't name where it's like, okay, those facts are just not, you know, reasonable people cannot agree on that, right? I mean, there is just something that is fundamentally off about, you know, the data. I mean, I read the Peter Navarro's Immaculate Deception, I think it was, and it's like, okay, let me look into that footnote. And then it's just like, oh, that I can't find any justification for that number anywhere, right? Where it's not just that the narrative is off or there's subjectivity in that, it's that the factual predicate is utterly lacking. But when you have when people start to view politics as, you know, an extension of a tribal identity, and that becomes your sense of purpose, you know, not a sense of purpose in terms of advocating or trying to make the world a better place through a policy outcome, but just, you know, if my team loses, it is the end of the world, right? The Flight 93-ification, you know, of our entire system. Then you lose that sense of the churn of the wheel that turns, and sometimes you're on top, and then, you know, maybe you'll overplay it and you'll be on the bottom, but you'll wait for the other guy to overplay it and you'll get back up on top. You know,
well, Peter, I think about too, like, no, go ahead and finish your thought, because I had a real quick thing to tackle.
Yeah, I mean, just when you have that fidelity to finding out a factual basis, then you can put things in context, and you don't catastrophize, you know, and have that sense of the world always ending.
Yeah, and if you, during this whole steel thing, I remember for about a week, there were people sending me stuff saying that they have proof that the DOD attacked a CIA server farm in Germany with proof of stealing. Like, okay, that's not just ludicrous. It's also really destroying the last institution that people trust, which is the military, which is also, I mean, they don't even trust the CIA anymore. That's now political. And which, by the way, the military is the one thing that we knew would protect us on January 6th if push came to shove. You know, people ask me, well, with country first, you know, what happens if XYZ? I'm like, well, look, we don't know where the Republican Party is going. We don't know the trend. I think we'll see a trend in the summer. But all I know is if somebody's not presenting the counter message of saying, you know, country before party, nothing's going to happen. And so I think part of what I've seen has worked is, you know, as Peter was saying, if I could have 750,000 individual conversations, I think everybody would agree or at least respect the position. But I think it's just in short sound bites, convincing people the truth, which is you did what you thought was right. You're still a conservative. You did what you thought was right. And they can disagree on the subjects. But I don't know. Peter's much better at persuasion than I am.
I mean, it's honestly very hard. I mean, I think that, you know, again, I think the worst thing you can do in persuading is to be insulting, belittling, rude, you know, because then even if somebody ultimately comes around to agreeing with you, they'll still think you're, you know, a dick. So, I mean, it starts with that sense of just, you know, kind of trying to meet people where they are and understanding that they arrived at their beliefs just as you arrived at yours. Now, where I have found that success is just sort of that, you know, if Adam and I just kind of said, you know what, now that I think about it, that was wrong. Like, I apologize. I've seen some people in my own state basically do one thing and then back away from it. And not only have you lost the respect, not only did the people that you now pretend to agree with don't trust you, but you've lost the respect of everybody that was on the other side, right? I think there's a sense of you can be, if you're, you know, principled and firm in your convictions, and you patiently try to explain it. I mean, the more times I spend kind of even talking with GOP groups, I mean, there are people who come out of there being like, well, I still disagree with it, but, you know, they gain a respect. And I think gaining that respect is the first point to the first step in having someone be like, oh, maybe that wasn't, you know, that didn't confirm my worst suspicions, right? It may not have changed it, but you kind of, you crack that door open just a little bit. But I think everything else takes time.
You know, politics used to be respectful, and we can track the slow arc of disrespect and the slow arc of where, you know, in our case, Democrats went from being competitors to enemies. And I think we just have to be realistic that it's a slow arc back. But I'll tell you two things I'm hopeful for: the next generation. I think people my age and younger are going to be the ones that save politics in this country because they've seen nothing but the garbage and they're sick of it. They may not know how to get there, but they want to. And I think people have to demand more of their leaders. Everybody looks to DC to solve problems or to change the tone. But we, you know, honestly, politicians just reflect what's going to vote for them. And I think it's up to people to demand more. You look at social media, you know, what is it? Social Dilemma on Netflix talks about how new media radicalizes and stuff, but that's for people waking up to see, I think, too.
Yeah, and I'll say that you fear what you don't know, right? And the more we become tribal in sort of our media consumption and in our, you know, kind of geographic and just kind of social circles, the harder it is to kind of find people that. And I think, frankly, our culture is also leading toward this, and the left deserves plenty of blame. And just sort of that idea of any deviation, like, how dare you have that opinion, right? When I was in high school, I founded our Teenage Republicans Club, and my best friend founded the Young Democrats. And I used to really enjoy having you know, debates that weren't, oh, you awful so-and-so, and kind of devolving into ad hominem, but ones where it's like, okay, let's track back to the point at which we diverge, right? Where is that disconnect? Like, I found that to be a very worthwhile, legitimate exercise, because again, even if you still come out in a fundamental disagreement, you can at least respect how that person arrived at those points. But you have to be able to talk to somebody to do that. Yeah. And I remember I was involved in some kind of political reform conversations in 2017. And we had a pollster who came in who was kind of describing a concept I've never heard of before called negative polarization, right? It's exactly what you said. It's, you know, Democrats aren't Democrats because they love the Democratic Party. It's because they hate Republicans. Republicans aren't Republicans because they love the Republican Party. They hate Democrats. And when you have a system set up like that, it can be good for mobilizing turnout and kind of in, getting your base out to vote. But I think it is fundamentally very toxic to the body politic. And it results in what we, it results in some of the confrontations. I mean, the folks, you know, pushing up and kind of assaulting Rand Paul over the summer, you know, chanting, you know, say her name about Breonna Taylor. And it's like, this guy freaking introduced the Justice for Breonna Act, right? But just, he's a Republican, so he must be evil. And frankly, we saw the same thing at the Capitol, where it's just, if you're not with us, you know, then you are traitors to this country. We're the patriots. I had a supporter of mine, well, former, who texted me the night of the sixth and said, you know, it was the patriots who stormed the building, the traitors were the ones who were inside. Now, this guy also texted me 5 days later and said, what are you talking about? That wasn't Trump supporters, that was Antifa and BLM. I'm like, it can't be both, unless our politics are way more convoluted than even the chaos I ascribe to them.
I think for Country First as a movement, as I envision it, it's doesn't take a position on issues. It just says, here's a low bar, but unfortunately eliminates 85% of people. Are you going to tell the truth? Are you going to not peddle in conspiracies? And are you going to not use fear as a motivator? If that's what you are, you're Country First, right? You believe that the country is more important than this moment in your politics or your election. And now the interesting thing about the name Country First, you know, in the back of my head, I obviously knew it was McCain's, but that's not why I chose it. But I am so glad, and it's almost fortuitous or spiritual, that it happened, because Meghan McCain texted me and then many of the McCain alum and just said, thank you. I'm getting a little choked up because I love John. But they just said, you know, thank you for doing it, for honoring him. And that was a big honor. So, yeah. So, no, it wasn't intentional, but it's fortuitous.
What were some of the things that they were saying to you when they texted you?
Meghan was just like, you know, that was my dad's. And I'm like, yeah. And I was like, oh no, she's gonna be mad. And she's like, thank you. You know, that's amazing. And some of the other McCain alum just like, you know, kind of seeing that legacy live on. And, you know, it's an honor. Like I said, I never intended to be in this position. I never intended to lead or be part of, you know, this kind of thing. But it just, sometimes you got to take the moment and say, well, the country needs this. And, you know, it's like when Peter took some really tough votes, you know, we all took tough votes. It's like, this is a moment in time that history books will write about. And if they're right that we did the wrong thing, then I think the country will be in a much worse place later anyway.
Peter, have you thought of McCain the last month or so in dealing with all this?
I mean, I think there's something to be said for, you know, I mean, what just that notion of a bit more of a maverick, right? And I remember in 2000 during the Republican primary, all the candidates came to Calvin College in Grand Rapids, and they hosted a debate, and I was so excited and I wanted to meet John McCain, and I had the little pamphlet and went up, and John McCain just kind of peaced out because he had better things to do. But Orrin Hatch stuck around and he signed my thing, and his message was, always listen to your parents, Orrin Hatch. And that seems like the most Hatchian thing, but just that sense of, I mean, you can, I think we're seeing a lot of politicians right now who they look at moments and they think, oh, here's a good opportunity to go this lane or go that lane, without mentioning any senators with 2024 aspirations. Yeah. It's clear with the electoral college certification, like, oh, one guy's doing this. Okay. Another's going to one up by doing that. Right. Senators, Cotton and Romney put out, this bill. Oh, well, how do I kind of get ahead of that? Like that just kind of naked opportunism, versus the, and to be clear, I'm not referring to Senators Romney and Cotton in that. I think they're actually pursuing ideas, but just that sense of looking at everything as a competition and kind of a horse race, rather than saying, hey, I'm going to do what I think is in the best interest. And I hope that is recognized. I hope that, you end up, John Boehner said, a leader without anyone behind them is just taking a walk. Right? I hope I'm not just taking a walk, but I think on this vote, if in the end, we're in the wrong, I'd rather be sort of, that still isn't going to change, what we're doing. If this is a futile attempt to try to bring the Republican Party back to a place where there can be some organizing principles and a shared sense of collective truth and objective reality, if that's not something that, I would rather you do it even if it's futile, because if it is ultimately futile, then that's, and we get kicked out of the party, then that's probably not a party that we should be a part of.
Amen. Adam, take the last word.
Look, first off, thanks, Peter, and thanks for everybody. I wish we could take a ton more questions. And but I just want to say, we're in a real moment. I get asked a lot, like, how can this narrative compete against this narrative out there of, anger? And the truth is, we can't without people. And, people standing up and showing that they want something different, that they expect more. You deserve more, frankly. We've inherited this amazing legend that our founding fathers put together and generations fought to defend. We don't really have a right to give up on it. I mean, it's not even a choice that we have. And so I think it's a matter of growing a movement, being outspoken, showing a different way, being more optimistic than pessimistic. And most importantly, fear is a motivator, but let's quit manipulating fears for our own personal gain. And let's put the country first. And that's what this whole country first idea is about. And I'd encourage anybody that hadn't gone to the website, countryfirst.com, with the number one, and just, take a look and join. And I think if we can be, whether it's this movement or whether it's the nine other companies of heroes in the House with me that voted, really tough votes, be the movement to change, we can do that.
Gentlemen, it has been a pleasure. Your homework assignment this weekend is to watch Roadhouse. I'm making you do it. Just get it done. Congressman Kinzinger and Congressman Meyer, thank you very much. It has been fun. And thank you to everyone in the room as well. Like I mentioned before, this is a first in a series of conversations that Country First will be hosting on the need to put country over party. We invite you to visit the website. We've said a lot. We'll keep saying it a lot. Countryfirst.com. That's with a one. Countryfirst.com. Make sure you subscribe to receive all the latest updates as well. My name is Matt Rodewald. Thank you again for joining us. We will see you next time.
Thank you.